Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Now, whether it's pitching you a product you didn't know you needed, selecting music for you, or telling you what route to take home from work this evening, big data has become an integral part of modern life. And its importance will only be more pronounced in the future. But what might be surprising to hear is that it is also having a huge impact in our understanding of the past. Rowan McLaughlin is a researcher at the Hamilton Institute at Maynooth University. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Rowan. Tell me a little bit about your work and what you're interested in. What's your research area?
Hello. Well, I'm an archaeologist and I apply statistics and data science to try to explore the past. So we generally look together past information using historical records or digging up archaeological artifacts. My work tries to really apply data science and statistics to all these discoveries to try to find hidden patterns and trends and try to reconstruct past population sizes.
Right. And so do you run chemical analysis, mass spectroscopy on these items to try and figure out what they're made of, where they're from, or what's your focus?
Yes. Well, indirectly, yes. I mean, the last 20 years has seen a real revolution in the archaeological sciences, as we call it. So extracting as much scientific information as we possibly can from artifacts and things that have been unearthed from ancient sites. So my work especially looks at radiocarbon dates. So this is a dating technique that allows us to determine independently of any other information how old something is, simply by measuring the amount of natural radioactivity that's present in the sample.
Walk me through the science of that again, how radiocarbon dating works, because I have forgotten it.
Well, high above our heads, high in the atmosphere, the Earth is colliding with charged particles from outer space. Most of them come from the sun. And this gives the atmosphere a degree of natural radioactivity because cosmic rays strike the atmosphere. They turn the nitrogen in the atmosphere into a radioactive isotope of carbon, carbon-14. And this becomes carbon dioxide. And it eventually makes its way down to the ground where plants gather it up. They photosynthesize carbon dioxide. They create carbohydrates and proteins formed from that carbon dioxide. And that makes its way up the food web. So humans or any other animals, we essentially are what we eat. The atomic substance of our bodies is ultimately derived from the atmosphere. And a tiny fraction of that is naturally radioactive. There's an equilibrium that exists between the biosphere and the atmosphere in terms of that natural radioactivity. But when we die, when living things die, that equilibrium stops and that natural radioactivity gradually transforms the carbon-14 into an inert, radioactively dead substance. You know, that natural radioactivity dies away. It's got a half-life of over 5,000 years. Which means it's a very slow clock, if you like.
So you're saying that living things stop the decay of carbon-14, and then when we die, it's like someone presses go on a 5,000-year clock.
Yes, it's like starting a stopwatch, this radioactive stopwatch. So after 55,000 years or so, the amount of radioactivity that's left is basically immeasurable. You know, that's 10 half-lives down the line. So there's too little of that radioactive carbon-14 left to measure. But unbelievably, we can date to within a century or sometimes less any organic sample that has been alive in the last 55,000 years. So
How then, this is going to sound like a really stupid question, but I always promise myself on this program, never be afraid of asking a stupid question. How then can we tell if something is 250 million years old?
Well, we can turn to other isotopes, other elements, uranium, and you know, geologists use different dating techniques, but based on the same idea that there's natural radioactivity is a very good indicator of how long ago an event happened because it's a stopwatch that runs independently of of everything else. It's basically that we're using the laws of physics to our advantage to try to date something.
Right. So if we're using carbon, we can have a nice tight time scale. We can do it within 100 years. But if we use other isotopes, we get less accuracy. And that's why we use carbon for human related remains. Is that right?
Exactly. Right. With other isotopes, with other elemental isotopes, we can extend the time scale back millions of years. But for Ireland, for the archaeology of Ireland, which has only been occupied by humans for the last 11, 12, 13,000 years, carbon 14 is of prime use to us. It's extremely useful indeed.
Right. So talk to me about what you're looking at from the Irish records. What exactly does your work focus on, and what sort of samples are you dating, and what does it tell us about human activity in Ireland?
Well, one of the wonderful things about doing this kind of work in Ireland is that we have a vast amount of data that actually came from the Celtic Tiger era. The motorways and other large infrastructural projects, as they were being built, it is a legal requirement for archaeologists to come and check the sites, check the routeways, to ensure that any ancient sites that are being disturbed, most of which are very modest, you know, they appear as shadows and traces of things in the ground, not necessarily very elaborate and identifiable monuments or features like that. But they all tell us a little bit of information. So in Ireland, there's been over 20,000, maybe 25,000, something like that, individual archaeological excavations, many of which have given us samples of radiocarbon dates or other scientific information about the past lives. And these are all very interesting in themselves, because we can tell when townlands were inhabited and when towns were formed. We can find human remains from thousands of years ago and test the bones to see what they ate. So there's lots of individual detail that's of intrinsic interest.
Sorry, pause for a second. You said test the bones to see what they ate.
Yeah, related to carbon dating, we can do something called stable isotope analysis, which is a similar idea. We are what we eat, so there are chemical traces of the food that we eat that end up in our bones. We can't tell with any great detail, but we can differentiate, for example, between eating a lot of fish and eating a lot of terrestrial protein, you know, like milk and cereal and things like that. And we can also differentiate actually between cereals and meats, which is or dairy products, which in Irish history is extremely significant, because dairying was a huge part of the economy for thousands of years, as it turns out. So this scientific information we can extract from archaeological materials tells us much more about the past than we could hope to glean from looking at the shape of pots, ancient pottery finds or stone tools or something like that.
So talk to me about what you have learned then about Irish populations over time that we couldn't have done without this approach to data science. So obviously we had Vikings, we had other types of populations in Ireland. They grew and dissipated over the years. What have you learned?
Well, the results have been really quite surprising and in many ways challenging to the conventional narratives about Irish history and Irish archaeology. Not so much that there were different groups of people around in the past, but the relative size of these groups and the speed at which they grew sometimes, or the speed at which they disappeared, has been surprising. And what's also surprising is the overall scale of activity is quite remarkable. It is just a statistical estimate, but there could have been populations as large as 1 million people in the island of Ireland going back 6,000 years.
Wow. 1 million people.
Yes. And this is...
Like, I just give context to people for that with regards to what we may have thought beforehand. And if we were imagining sort of a linear growth of a population, what we would have expected to see that. So, because 1 million people sounds like a lot when you go that far back.
It certainly does. And there's a kind of paradox when we think about demographic history, about population history, because the past represents a long time, and that's a long time for populations to come and go. So the conventional approach, the conventional view was that in the distant past, so in the Stone Age, 6,000 years ago, there was few people, you know, maybe an island with, say, 10,000, but these are just guesses based on, nothing really whatsoever, no empirical.
A lot of assumptions, yeah.
And making a lot of assumptions. Human populations can grow very quickly. We see this in lots of parts of the world today. And in Ireland, there's, you know, everybody is as a granny or a great granny who had 14 children. I mean, you know,
yeah.
Given the right conditions, populations can grow incredibly quickly. Our species, if you like, is very, very good at this. Certainly compared to other large primates, if you want to look at us in purely biological terms. So it's a mystery as to why there are so few people today, when you consider the biological capacity of our population to grow very quickly. And so what happened was, yes, there were episodes in the past when there was a lot of people around. And this is why things like the landscape could be cleared of trees, or the land could be enclosed, and, you know, major changes.
Infrastructure sort of projects needed to be undertaken. They needed the bodies for that. Is that the evidence that you're suggesting that we had large populations?
Exactly. But critically, they didn't stay large. There was a constant ebb and flow of the population. They could grow quite quickly. They reached maybe a carrying capacity of the environment, or something else happened, and then the population levels tilted into a decline. And that explains why there are so few people around today rather than so many.
Research specifically looks at before the Vikings arrived, that there was a serious decline for almost two centuries. I think it's absolutely fascinating to think about. How on earth can you know? I mean, by finding items here and there and dating items, you can have an idea of what people ate and where people were. But how on earth can you do a body count when you're talking about thousands of years ago?
It is difficult, and we are making quite a lot of assumptions ourselves in doing this. But again, because of the Celtic Tiger era and because of the random like sample of the landscape that we got, if you look at a motorway, it's like a random transect across the whole island. Previously, before large infrastructure, archaeologists really had to work in a very piecemeal nature. You know, individual sites would be of interest. So archaeologists would, you know, excavate a particular site to find out a particular thing about a particular place. Large infrastructural projects are they're not totally random, because they do go along routeways that connect modern day towns to modern day towns. And a lot of those modern day towns are built on ancient medieval or Viking towns or cities, especially in Ireland. So it's not entirely random, but it gives us a transect of the landscape. And you mentioned big data at the start, and that's the key point. We really do have so much data that a lot of other sources of bias, like not all sites are as visible. Archaeologists are more interested in some time periods than other ones.
Yeah.
These are definitely things that we need to factor in to the way that we try to undertake the statistical modeling. But when we do that, we find that the density of evidence per century is not the same. So there's a lot of evidence, say, 6,000 years ago in the early Neolithic period. There's a lot of evidence from 2,000 years ago in the Iron Age. And there's an incredible amount of evidence from the first millennium AD, so the early medieval period, the early Christian era, as it used to be called. That really peaked at around the year 680. And then it started to decline quite slowly. And we don't know why. I mean, there's plenty of ideas of why that might be, but there's no climate catastrophe, for example. There's no outbreak of disease or war that exactly aligns with these tilt points. But it did happen, and we often see phases for the recent millennium anyway, when new people that we know did come in, like the Vikings in the 8th, 9th century, like the Normans in the 13th century, you know, they did arrive at moments when the demography was changing anyway. And in many ways, this is probably the same pattern drove change right throughout the millennia. when the Bronze Age arrived, and these were people who were very much the direct ancestors of the inhabitants of Britain and Ireland today.
Yeah.
You know, the original, well, not the original, but the preceding Neolithic population, it was in decline. So the reason why they kind of took over, or the reason why we see
such success with these invasions, is that there weren't as many people as there are today, or certainly, obviously not today, but at other times, which would kind of fit, I suppose, in terms of looking at the sort of approach into the future. Like, if you could wave a magic wand, what would be the next sort of innovation or application of AI or big data to give us a really rich understanding of what happened in our past?
Yeah, in many ways, we're really at the start of a new era for archaeology, because we've barely scratched the surface of what can be achieved. I use radiocarbon dates because they're numbers, and numbers are very conducive to statistical modeling, and it's in many ways very simple. But there is an opportunity now to, for example, look at text and look at descriptions of things in the same way as we look at models. That's what large language models are, for example.
Yeah.
And these technologies certainly have the capacity to do a superhuman amount of work in terms of reading and trying to correlate the different descriptions of things. And then we can trace how societies in general evolved through time in that way. Mm. Because, you know, culture, language, human behavior itself is a kind of thing that evolves. It's all learned. Yeah. So it changes through time. And there's certainly there's a brave new world out there that's going to be able to do a lot more detailed reconstruction of the evolution of behavior itself through deep time, using these new approaches to understanding data that we have thanks to AI and related technologies.
Yeah, really interesting speaking with you. Rowan McLaughlin is a researcher at the Hamilton Institute at Maynooth University. Rowan, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.